This program is part of the 2015 Platform Series, Music Matters, sponsored by Ernst & Young and the John and Marcia Goldman Foundation. Well, it is finally time to introduce our speakers. Nicholas McGeegan begins his 30th year as music director of Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra. He's acknowledged as one of the world's leading conductors of Baroque music. And he was also artistic director of the International Handel Festival, Göttingen, for 20 years. McGeegan's notable accomplishments with period performance ensembles and his approach to engage players and audiences internationally make him a pioneer, if you will, in broadening the scope of historically informed music. He often pairs Baroque concert repertoire with classic, romantic, and 20th century works. He also frequently conducts and teaches students at universities and music schools nationwide, including here at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. Nick will be joined in today's conversation by Dr. Kate Van Orden, a professor of music at Harvard University who specializes in cultural history. Her books, Music and the Book in the First Century of Print, which I told you about, and Music in the Cultures of Print, and Materialities, Books, Readers, and the Chanson in 16th Century Europe. She has performed regularly as a bassoonist with Philharmonia Baroque, as well as American Bach soloist, Tafel Music, Handel and Haydn Society, and Boston Baroque. Kate? Would you like to begin? So, Kate Van Orden and Nicholas McGeegan. Thank you. In conversation.
Thanks very much, Anne, for the invitation to be here. And Nick, it's such a real pleasure to be able to ask you some questions that I hope are not just interesting for me as one of your players, but for other people in the audience. To start, how did you get into conducting?
Oh, that happened a long time ago. I was at school. You can tell by the accent that I'm not a local. And I am now, perhaps. I went to school in England, and one of the things that happened there is on Saturday mornings, each county has a music school sponsored by the county. And I was there with a bunch of string players, and I was the one who didn't play a string instrument and therefore was useless. And therefore they said, well, why don't you conduct, because we all disagree on everything, so you can be in the firing line. I was 18, I think. And so I got to conduct. The first piece I conducted was Richard Strauss's Metamorphosen. And it's been downhill ever since. And then I went to university, where I went to Cambridge University, which is a university which operates along different lines to other universities. They don't really care whether you learn anything. They just want to teach you how to think. So you don't have to go to any lectures. You have private tuition. And the questions in the history exam are such things as, Mozart's music is so simple only children can play it. Agree or disagree. And you have 3 hours. It's not remembering facts. So that kind of stuff was fun. So music, which playing, performing music, which you do not do for credit, there's no such thing, is very much part of musical life. So I got to conduct, while I was there, the chamber orchestra, the first orchestra, and the second orchestra. Not in that order. Second orchestra, then the first one, and the opera, and the university opera company. So I did absolutely everything, except sing, which is a great relief to all of us.
When we see you on stage, we see you play the keyboard quite a bit, but a lot of people don't realize that Nick also plays the Baroque flute, and I'm wondering how that played into your early career as you moved between conducting and playing.
Sure. Well, I went up to university in Cambridge playing the modern flute. I got in playing Varese's Density 21.5 from memory, something I couldn't do now. And then in the second year of university, one of the things one of the courses that you were advised to take if you wished to pass the exam was a thing on the acoustics of instruments and buildings. Why? How instruments work. And there was a very nice chap, it was a climatologist who's no longer with us, unfortunately, but he was Sir Nicholas Shackleton, and he collected ancient clarinets and flutes and all sorts of 18th century wind instruments, and he lent me an 18th century flute, which I actually just gave back to Edinburgh University, where his collection now is. And he had a tenant who lived in the top floor of his house who was hardly ever there, but his name was Christopher Hogwood. And when Chris was home, once I had worked out how to play the Baroque flute without total embarrassment, Chris said, well, why don't you come and play some sonatas? And so I then joined his orchestra and played in the very first recording that he ever made with the Academy of Ancient Music, which was his group. And that was a symphonies by Thomas Arne, in which I played a couple of slow movements, I think. And that was back in 1973 or four.
Yeah, so it's really when people were just, it was very homegrown and local.
It was all a little, it was all fairly hair-raising, I have to say. partly because we recorded remarkably close to Heathrow, which meant even then that no take on a recording could last more than about 2 minutes without a plane going over. And so it was rather like a patchwork quilt, those early recordings. They're made up of hundreds of little bits of tape, literally cut and spliced and put together with sticky tape. Nothing digital in those days. And I remember then I did a recording with Chris of John Christian Bach flute sonatas. That's a misnomer. They're piano sonatas with flute accompaniment. Gentlemen and music teachers played the flute. Ladies played the keyboard. And so these were sonatas, they're called chaperone sonatas, where the harpsichord or the piano has all the tunes, and the flute plays very long notes, so that meant that mother didn't have to be there while the music teacher was teaching the daughter, because you know that his hands were on the flute rather than a member of the family.
It's true, it does take two hands to play.
It does take two hands to play. And the only problem with that recording is that we did it in Finchcox, which is in Kent. And one afternoon, a cow in a field decided that it was time to give birth. And so a whole afternoon was completely wasted from frantic mooing. None of which, of course, was then caught on tape. But so we just went to the pub for the day, I seem to remember. And I think the calf survived.
So my recollection, and I'm a little bit came into this a little bit later than you, is that in the 70s and 80s, the early music movement really had a kind of countercultural edginess to it. And a lot of groups, especially on the continent, were embracing a politics of diversity and openness, really equality, that was in marked contrast to the monoculture of the modern symphony. If you think of, say, like the Vienna Phil at that time was not hiring women or any visibly ethnic minority players. So I'm wondering what your recollection of those years were from a political standpoint, or just what the early musicians felt they were trying to do.
I think one thing was we had to put up with an enormous amount of snobbism from regular orchestra players who thought that we weren't good enough to play in their orchestras, therefore we did what we did. We can play Rachmaninoff, you can only play Bach. Mm-hmm. they used to have these terrible things called the Battle of the Bands, which was they put a modern orchestra next to a Baroque orchestra. I mean, absolutely stupid. The idea is that both should win if they were any good. I suppose some of it was a bit brown rice and Birkenstocks, but I don't remember that particularly in London. It was definitely a very laddish culture in the symphony orchestras. You have to remember this is back in the 70s when every music stand had an ashtray on it,
mm-hmm.
for example. The only woman playing usually played the harp. And she was certainly not invited to the pub afterwards.
Right, and she's an extra.
Yes, she was never allowed to be a member of the orchestra. That sort of is how Vienna still is, actually, though they don't admit it. And so it was very snobby. And then when people like Chris started to win record prizes for recording, it was somehow felt that this was demeaning the real musicians who played in the grand symphony orchestras. And I remember even coming here when Philharmonia played Handel's Giustino with the Merula program way back in the 80s. Certain members of the opera were extremely snooty to us and said, well, I mean, we could learn those instruments in a week and do it. And so for some of us just said, want to try?
Well, yeah. I mean, back in the 80s, the Chicago Symphony wind section, a lot of those players were learning classical instruments in addition to their own, and had this idea that eventually the Chicago Symphony would play everything on the historically specific instruments. And that really didn't work, because it's hard to to maintain that level and to even achieve it initially.
Although, having said that now, that was all changed, because if you go to a college like Juilliard or the Royal College of Music, you can learn modern violin, modern flute, baroque violin, both. And you can also play jazz and all sorts of things. The musicians of today, the younger ones, are much more broadly educated than the college musicians of 40 or 50 years ago. And that's a very good thing, let me say. I think it's brilliant that Juilliard has a period instrument ensemble, which is actually coming to play on a side-by-side with Philharmonia in November in both Stanford and in Berkeley. And I think that's terrific.
Yeah.
We'll have to play very well, otherwise they'll take our jobs.
I'll make a note of that. You know, you're one of the people who moves between early music bands and modern symphony orchestras. I mean, next week maybe, you'll be down at the Hollywood Bowl
with the
LA Phil. Next
week is the Cleveland Orchestra, and the week after that's the LA Phil. Yeah, very respectable.
So I'm wondering, when you walk into that other environment, do you find that some modern symphonies are resistant to spending time with detailed work on, say, a Haydn symphony, when those classical symphonies are usually shorted in rehearsal schedules in favor of, you know, preparing other kinds of work?
I think it all depends, frankly, on how prepared you are. If I'm working with, Cleveland or LA Phil, I bring my own music. So everything I want is in there. They just have to play it. It seems to me that conductors shouldn't preach. That is, preaching is best left to the professionals. Or in my case, ignored.
So when you say you bring your own music, you mean you bring parts for
all
the players?
I have all my own parts, with the bowings I want, with the trills that I want, so that it's all camera ready, as it were, for any musician, be a baroque musician or a... And some of the things, for example, there are some differences, say, between, let's just say, an American orchestra or a British orchestra and a German orchestra. If I want, in French music, for example, and this is where a conductor shouldn't sing, but he's going to, if you get something that goes ya-da-da-da-da, a French orchestra in the 18th century will go ba-ba-da-ba-dum. Now, I can just write swing over the top, and an American or British orchestra knows exactly what it is. German orchestra, what is swing? I remember Donald Ronicles telling me the most depressing rehearsal he ever had was doing the suite from West Side Story with a German orchestra, which was played with deadly accuracy, which, of course, killed it. I tell you, one of the things that's miserable about being a conductor is being a young one. It's much better to be in your 60s, as I am, and the musicians to be in their 20s than the other way around, where they don't say, oh, we've done this piece 300 times, lad, is this your first?
Exactly, and they already know how to bow it and don't
yes.
need new bowings.
Well, there was a fantastic story about a conductor with an orchestra that I won't name, who was a conductor in his 20s. He's very famous, and he showed up at a very famous American orchestra with a new, very good Bernreiter set of parts for one of the Mozart symphonies. Concertmaster looked at it for about 2 minutes, put it on the floor, trod on it, and said, get the other parts. They were good enough for Toscanini, and they should be good enough for you, my boy.
Right. It's back to the just play the notes.
Yes. He conducts the Berlin Philharmonic, if you want to know who he is.
You can put two and two
my
together yourself.
My boy has grown up.
So your conducting career involves so many different skills because it's not really just conducting, right? I mean, last week you were leading chamber music concerts at Aspen from the harpsichord. Next week, I guess next week is Cleveland, where you've got a program from, say, Bach to Schubert, but then down at the L.A. Phil.
You're doing Copeland. Jazz on the bass and Appalachian Spring, yeah.
Exactly. So, I mean,
it's all music, you know.
Well, I know, but what does early music bring to the mix that's really particular? What's it take to be a good early music conductor? And what do you think your early music experience brings to the, you know, your week with the Cleveland Symphony or L.A. Phil, other than starting off with good parts?
Yeah, well, one thing that's very different is that composers over the last 150, 200 years have started to put more and more and stuff in their music telling you how to play it. If you look at a modern score, it's absolutely covered in how to play it loud, with soft, short, long, metronome marks to tell you how fast it goes. If you look at a Bach score, there's none of that. It might have a tempo, it might not. It will have maybe one or two notes marked soft, one or two notes marked short, one or two articulations, and that's it. You're just supposed to know. And so, and of course, those musicians only played music that had been written the week before. They were only interested in new music. And so if you played in Haydn's orchestra, you played Haydn. You knew how it went. He didn't have to write things in. Bach's orchestra played an awful lot of Bach. They kind of knew his language. And so it's very different from a symphony orchestra that will be playing music from the 18th century one week, and the next week they'll be playing Brahms, and the week after that something that hasn't been finished yet. So my job is to second guess for a modern orchestra what Bach might have meant, how it might have sounded. Now, it doesn't matter whether that's on period instruments or on modern instruments, but it does matter, for example, the articulations, whether notes are short or long, whether the rhythms are played strictly. Also, if it's something as simple as a minuet, one of the things I had to learn was how to dance one. I'm not going to demonstrate. Fortunately, it's radio, and I don't have to. But nevertheless, if you don't know even roughly what speed a minuet is danced at, you've got no business playing one. Which is, if you hear old performances by some of my more stentorian colleagues from the 40s, 1940s, you couldn't dance at the hippo speeds that they conducted them at. It's just not possible to do it, because it never occurred to them, I suppose, that it was actually a piece of dance music. One of the things that we're lucky to do in the period instrument thing is not just about the instruments, but about dance, how the Baroque theatres worked. There's a lot more freedom, because one of the things that always comes up is ornamentation. The composers didn't write much in their scores because the performers were expected to embellish the music just like a jazz player does. They wrote only the bare minimum. Indeed, Bach was criticized for writing too much in his scores and not leaving the performers free enough to embellish as they thought fit.
Right, yeah, another question is that part of the excitement of Baroque music is precisely the fact that it's being invented at the moment, that there's this big latitude for the performer and those performers who know what to do with it.
I think it's great. I mean, my feeling is that the microwave has no place in a concert hall. In other words, the performance you gave yesterday shouldn't be the same as the one you're giving today. And one of the great things is that Robert Levin, who's a mutual friend of ours, well, he comes to Philharmonia quite often to play piano concertos by Mozart, and he improvises all the cadenzas. The orchestra comes to a crashing halt, and for 10 minutes he has to improvise. And he always beforehand says, what you're going to hear tonight, I'm making up, and if you don't like it, don't worry, because you'll never hear it again. And he said, it's like being in the circus, but without the net. There is no safety, and he might land on his nose. I've never, in the 30 years we've worked together, heard him land on his nose, but he could. Mozart would give a concert in which probably 20% of it was improvised. He didn't need music, he just played. And we've lost that. It's, music has become very formal, very structured, and it's based now on the music that's written down. The music notation, one must remember, and she is the professor, not me, but I'm going to put my professorial hat, my honorary professorial hat on for a second, to say that music notation is a way of remembering music that you already knew. It's not a means of learning something. And we've taken it now to say the written word as the written notes are somehow sacrosanct, and they're not.
Right.
That is merely, originally, was merely a sketch to help you remember what you already knew.
Well, and then the tension is also whether you're really featuring the composer as the person of genius who wrote all these notes down on the page, or whether it's the performer who's the real star, and that what you're looking at on the page is really a kind of transcription of somebody's wonderful performance, and whether we shouldn't always be trying to channel performers rather than composers.
Yes, and we have
composers.
To know that, of course, very often they're the same people. Mozart, Beethoven,
right,
and Haydn, not so much Haydn, although Dragonetti thought that Haydn was the second best pianist to Beethoven. These people did perform. Bach was a great performer.
Yeah.
It's only quite late on that you, in the 19th century, that you have composers who weren't known as performers.
Right, and in fact, it's easy to feel close to Mozart somehow when Robert Levin is playing, because it's like he's channeling a creative process that's happening before your eyes on stage.
Yes, I mean, I don't like going to temples of music. Bruckner went to Parsifal, I think, and kept his eyes shut the whole time because he was in a temple to Wagner. He didn't seem to notice who was performing or the performance of the acting or anything.
Right.
It was on his knees, as it were.
Well, and that was one of the other questions to ask about the early music movement in the 70s and 80s is about alternative venues, because, of course, you've got smaller bands that really aren't made to play in the same spaces that, say, Vienna Phil is playing.
Yeah, and most European concert halls are very much smaller than many American ones. The Met, for example, in New York, which actually has very good acoustics, it was said in the 18th century that if you were more than 60 feet away from the stage, you'd miss most of it. Well, that and the Met would take you to about the third row. And it's fine. The Met is a wonderful place, and it's great for Aida. But shall we say, Monteverdi's Coronation of Poppea does not have elephants in it. It's got an orchestra of about 15 and a fairly small cast. So not every opera house is suitable for early stuff. The Marriage of Figaro is best for an audience of about 1,000, not 4,000. I don't want to get a telescope to see what the singer's eyebrows look like. So most things, I'm very much looking forward to when Herbst Theatre reopens, because such is my experience there that it makes a wonderful opera house. The pit is the best place to play, the stage is fabulous, and I hope that we or the opera or somebody will start doing Mozart opera there. The pit would be wonderful, the sound is great for it, and everybody can really feel part of it. And as you say, the biggest concert hall in the 18th century was, I think, the Leipzig Gewandhaus, which was about 120 feet by 75. And in London, for one of Haydn's concerts, a gentleman wrote on his program about one of the Haydn symphonies, said it was good but very noisy. Now, we don't think of Haydn's symphonies as being noisy, because they're played in huge concert halls by orchestras that are usually smaller than the one he had.
Yeah,
they should
I know.
Actually pack a punch.
When you think about that orchestra, like jammed into this small space with all of these wind instruments, I mean, it must have just been really shocking.
And the audience jammed in too, with the gentlemen, the ladies being requested not to wear hoops in their skirts, and the gentlemen being asked to leave their swords at home. That wouldn't happen in Texas. Mozart had a funny time, actually, when he went to Paris and found all the orchestra were armed. That certainly affects your technique.
But on the other hand, I mean, period instruments are put together differently, right? They want to be heard in other spaces, not just because the groups can be smaller, but also because, I mean, I don't know who's going to lay this out for everyone, just to dip into technicalities for a minute, but the lower pitch and the way the instruments are constructed means that they speak differently to people.
Yeah. Modern instruments have developed for modern concert halls because there are more of us than there used to be. I can just say as a little aside about batons, because I don't use one, that they are an invention of the 19th century. As concert halls got bigger, they went from candlelight to gaslight, but it wasn't that good. And so conductors had to wear white gloves and carry a big white stick. And if you were Julien, an English conductor with a French name, you had a diamond in the end of it so that 300 people in the chorus could see you under totally dismal light. I don't use a baton because we've got electricity now. It's no longer a useful tool unless you have myopic people. It's quite useful in the opera house sometimes because I found that occasionally singers don't put their contact lenses in so that they don't have to look at the audience, which distracts them. It also means they can't see the conductor.
So you which can to, be helpful.
which I'm sure is a good idea. I wouldn't look if I could.
So let's talk a little bit about your programming for Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra, because every year there are so many surprises in the program, and I was wondering what your strategies are there artistically when you decide what music people are going to hear in a season.
Well, you're never going to please everybody is the first thing. Once you've gone into the sort of period instrument thing, you've become a bit of a musical gourmet. And therefore, you have to have the vegetarian option, the gluten-free option, the low-fat, the musical terms, the non-choral, somebody's not going to like something. I remember getting into a taxi once here, and someone said, well, I used to come to your concerts, but I don't like vocal music, so I didn't go anymore. Well, we'd play other things, you know. So we have what the Germans would call the Feinschmecker, the gourmets, who we used to have. If I remember the very first time I played Mozart, I actually got a piece of hate mail saying that we should play more Telemann and not this late stuff. That's kind of... we still get a bit of that. I remember replying to somebody that we'd play Telemann every concert if you'd give us $25 million. You'd be the only member of the audience. But
right.
For that, we'd do anything. We'd have a special series for you.
So, but there's this tension then between people who want to hear something they've already heard, and in a certain way, early music seems ideal for that, right? Because the music's been around. And yet, when we did this Rossini one-act opera last spring, I mean, beforehand, I was looking around, you know, to study my part, and the only parts I could find were like some crazy Russian version with the entire thing in Russian, handwritten, full of mistakes. And then we got these beautiful parts. So obviously, at some point in there, someone had done a lot of work to get us a, you know, great score of the Rossini. And I don't think it's just a problem for the orchestra librarian, but every time you choose to bring something that people haven't heard before to the stage, it must require a huge amount of work on your part put it together.
Is this microphone still working? I can't tell.
It is. Yes,
we have an entire cave full of librarian elves who work all year. There we go, it's back again. Work all year to see that we have enough music. The concert that we're doing in October is going to be the American premiere of Scarlatti Serenata, where the parts have had to be generated from the manuscript. It's been performed once since 1715. And here we are in 2015. So yes, basically what you have is two things when you try to balance. One is performances of pieces that the audience will know from elsewhere. In other words, if we play a Beethoven symphony, it will be very different from how the symphony plays it for a number of reasons. First of all, we're using instruments of the period. Secondly, we're doing it in a concert hall which is a third the size, and so it will pack a punch, but in a different way. It's a much more intimate experience than going to a large symphony hall anywhere. So that's the thing. It's a new take or an old take on something familiar. We might also obey Beethoven's metronome marks, which a lot of people don't do, so it's often we do our research. I'm actually doing the Pastoral Symphony in a couple of weeks in New York using a different ending for the slow movement. Now, you'd have thought Beethoven's symphonies are received wisdom, but in actual fact, Beethoven didn't like the ending of the second movement of the Pastoral Symphony, and so he wrote to the publisher and said, this is what I'd like, really, and it's, I consider it an improvement. And they wrote back and said, oh, sorry, Guff, it's already been published. Tough. So everyone plays, actually, what he didn't want. And so we're actually going to play what he thought was an improvement. It's one more longer. So you can still do all this stuff. So to some extent, period instrument, in the larger sense, is sort of the performance wing of musicology. There are people such as Kate who spend a long time in libraries searching out music. And you won't believe, maybe you will, but say the Cleveland Orchestra way back in the 60s and 70s, when George Sell was there, played, I think, 10 Haydn symphonies. And he said, why should we play any more? The audience wants those ones, that's enough.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a massive amount of incuriosity, to make up a rather hideous word there. Another thing, so we have different performances of well-known works. We then have modern first performances. I don't know if the Rossini was the first time a Rossini opera had been done on period instruments in the United States, but it pretty likely was. Then we have pieces which are by fairly famous composers, but not necessarily ones that you're likely to hear. We've done a good number of Handel oratorios and Handel operas, which don't get done that often. We've got Handel's Joshua coming up in a couple of years. I don't know if that's been done in the Bay Area or not. And it's not hard to find pieces by Handel, for example, that would certainly be a West Coast premiere, possibly an American premiere. I'm hoping to bring Mendelssohn's version of Handel's Acis and Galatea here, which would be an American premiere. You get two for the price of one, eh?
Right,
So it's this, luckily these composers, because they were writing always for next week, they had to write a lot. And that's a great benefit to us. Well, and of course they could always pass off old music as new music, because poor people travelled in the 18th century, rich people stayed at home and poor people came to them. So you could write a piece in Rome, go off to Venice and produce the piece again as new, and almost no one would know. A lot of those things are very different from now. I mean, the idea of a lady or a gentleman sunbathing in the 18th century would be unheard of. That meant you worked in the fields. You never went out in the sun. It's only in the 19th century, when trains and things came along, that you sunbathed to show you were rich enough to go to the south of France. It's all snobbism.
Well, speaking of France, and actually this is about programming too, you know, you're a real champion of French music, and that's always been such a hard sell in the United States. Basically, French music's rarely heard outside of France, and yet you've built up a real audience for that. So I'm kind of wondering, again, in the same lines, how you've managed to develop an audience's taste for something really unusual and stylistically very different and definitive in a certain way of Baroque music.
Well, there's a couple of things here, but thank you for that. One thing is, of course, that we have in the Bay Area with Berkeley, Stanford, Conservatory of Music, and just everybody here, a very, very sophisticated musical public. This, I think, has more, the city and the area has more homegrown great music making than any other place in the United States. Now, Bostonians will go like this, and I would say, so where's the opera? New York has fabulous stuff, but it's nearly always brought in. It's important. They order in.
Yeah.
We have it here. We have great ballet. We have Oakland East Bay Symphony. We have Philharmonia. We have ABS. We have the great choirs. We have the symphony and MTT, and great new music scene as well. So this is where it's at, actually. I know a lot of people don't want to hear that, but they don't live here, so but they should visit. So if you, if by any chance you are visiting, welcome. And French music is also great because Rameau, the composer who wrote the best of it, who was a very cranky character, it was said he was only kind to anyone by mistake, and wrote for a very large orchestra. And a lot of Baroque music, Bach particularly, is written for very tiny orchestras. But Handel wrote for a large orchestra because he was working in London, which was rich. Rameau at the Court Opera in Paris had a big orchestra, probably bigger than ours. He had as many as 16 double basses, which is a convention as far as I'm concerned. And he also wrote for dance. And of course, one of the things that we haven't talked about is collaborations which Philharmonia is able to do. And we've collaborated more often than anybody, I think, with Mark Morris Dance Group. Mm-hmm. We first started that, we're going on 25 years for that. Philharmonia is having its 35th anniversary this year, my 30th, the chorale's 20th, but 25 years of collaborating with Mark Morris, which did actually include a Rameau opera, Platé, which I very much hope we'll bring back, because it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. And I'm in the front row, well, not in the front row, I'm in the front row, conducting it, trying to wipe the smile off my face and to be able to conduct at the same time. But it's wonderful stuff to do, and it is great. It's some of the most beautiful orchestra music, aside from the dance and everything else. And of course, let me just say that working with Mark Morris is about as much fun as you can have legally and in public.
So let me ask you one more question to kind of tie all of this together, because we've been talking. What I love is that you move back and forth between sort of the letter of the law and getting the notes right and the spirit of Baroque music and authenticity. You've really worked all over the world. You've conducted in Drottningholm Court Theater. You've played and performed in churches across Europe. And yet here you are on the West Coast.
Yippee.
And yeah, but I mean, the question is really, and this is kind of, you know, being a booster for where we are, but what is it about the West Coast? We don't have those historical sites, right, that seemed initially so important to early music. And yet there's this energy behind early music here in the Bay Area.
You've got a number of things. First of all, you've got great universities with great libraries where a lot of this music is. We're hoping to do a Rameau opera in a couple of seasons where the manuscript is actually in UC Berkeley. And so that it's here. Stanford, of course, has terrific stuff. And then we have the musicians who want to come here because it's a great place to make music. And any town, of course, that has great coffee and great wine is likely to have period instrument players. And just the audiences are terrific. And that's not audiences, shall we say, of a certain age. We also have a big responsibility to build up audiences, the donating audience of the future, shall we call it. And because this is a very slightly countercultural place, it's less stuffy than Zurich, shall we say. Well, almost anywhere is, actually. Then you can have people come to informal concerts. We have a series called Sessions, which is where you bring a glass of wine into the show. We'll talk about the music. It's very... You don't have to wear a tie.
Right. So if it was always about new music and finding a spot in classical music for expression, then that in fact works really well here.
It's permanently casual Friday as far as I'm concerned. And I think that's great because you shouldn't have to feel that you have to go to the dry cleaners to put on a get your finest to go always to a concert. Concerts should be fun. That's the other thing. I mean, if we're not having fun on stage, there's no point in you coming. And we do have fun, and we hope you do too. And it should be exciting. We're not trying to give you sort of authenticity, to use that terrible word, as if it's some kind of pill that you have to swallow, because it will be good for you in the end. And, you know, we're not trying to improve in any way. It's about, music is supposed to be about passion, Beethoven said that he regarded his music as being the wine of ecstasy, and that he was Bacchus sending his audiences into joyous delirium. Now, I don't know if we can achieve that, but we'd certainly like to. Maybe it's certainly how I feel when I'm conducting Beethoven. But it shouldn't be that the classical music concerts where you sit on your hands and look as if your goldfish just died, and a rock concert is where everyone looks like the village people going crazy. They should be the same, basically.
Right. I want to applaud that.
we want to applaud you for your wonderful.
I can tell you one of the hardest things to do is to record Beethoven in the studio without an audience, because an audience gives the performers energy.
Yeah.
Because one thing that you might not realize is that the orchestra on stage hears the audience as clearly as you hear the orchestra. So every cough, splutter, and whisper we hear, because you're directing it right at us. Yeah. In the same way that you hear the violin soloist. But that, in a good way, is the energy that you give. When you say you can hear a pin drop in a hall, that is energy. And we get that. And that makes us play better.
Yeah.
Wonderful. We do have some questions, let us begin. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is an Arts Forum program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Nicholas McGeegan in conversation with Kate Van Orden.
Okay, you mentioned that Bach's and Haydn's musicians played music that was composed the previous week. Do you perform or listen to contemporary music? What are your thoughts and opinions about today's composers and their music?
Well, I actually, the Hollywood Bowl, I'm doing a piece that hasn't been finished yet. So, yes, I don't think anyone should go to an early music concert because they're avoiding modern music. That's a very shabby excuse to go for anything. We in this area have, of course, wonderful John Adams as one of the greatest American world and composers of the world currently. We've played contemporary music. I love it. And do quite a surprising amount of it. We've also commissioned some stuff with Philharmonia from Jake Heggie, and so on. We're actively in negotiation for a couple more, actually. Can't tell you about them yet till we've signed and sealed the deals, but I think it's great. I think modern composers are being challenged and sometimes thrilled by writing for period instruments, the sounds that we have, the harpsichords and the viols and the things that Baroque instruments that could do that modern instruments can't.
I mean, I have to say, my experience playing in the orchestra, and I know these questions are for you, but because we specialize in a more discrete repertory than what you do as a composer or as a conductor, playing a piece like Rameau, which challenges the limits of our instruments, feels very modern and new and kind of crazy when you encounter some of the harmonies, or the Rossini seemed energetic in a completely new way that wasn't part of the standard rep.
There's one thing that's just kind of interesting. I mentioned earlier about Christopher Hogwood's Academy of Ancient Music. That was an 18th century orchestra or music society called the Academy of Ancient Music. And in its statutes, it defined ancient music as any music over 20 years old.
So here's a good question to follow on from that comment. How and why did you get into historically informed music at Cambridge?
I think I answered that one through Christopher Hogwood and playing flute sonatas. Then I left Cambridge and went to Oxford, one does.
But it stuck, right?
And it stuck. We, of course, didn't have teachers. We had to read the books ourselves. So we didn't have any. And I went to teach at the Royal College. I was the youngest professor at the Royal College. I was 23. And actually had students. I couldn't believe it. They were about 4 years younger than me.
Watching you conduct is such a pleasure. How did you learn to conduct?
Well, one thing that all conductors should do is to take what we might call the Hippocratic Oath of conductors, which is to do no harm. I don't use a stick because I once put one behind my glasses. A conductor's job is to help and to explain clearly, help the musicians get a good performance, and to explain clearly on the behalf of the conductor what he, or happy to say now, she would like, and to, if necessary, be nice in correcting things that you think are going awry. Being a conductor is a unique job in the sense that you are a stage director, but you're also performing. A stage director sits in the audience, scowls, frets, and takes notes. Whereas a conductor has to do all that preparation, but then actually go and perform as well. So you have to be able to perform. I find some of my colleagues are a little vain. And the conducting is not about helping, it's more about the hair gel. doesn't really bother me that last bit that much, I have to say. Used to, but
no.
But one is there to help. One of the vanities is doing things from memory. There was a very famous conductor, one of the most famous in the world, who decided to do an opera from memory at Covent Garden, and 20 minutes in there was a power cut, and he had absolutely no means of restarting it because he didn't have a score. Therefore, he was completely useless.
Wow, you think you'd have one backstage something?
No. I mean, it was all about, I can do Pelléas and Mélisande from memory in the pit at Covent Garden.
Well, when
not about helping the singers who had to do it from memory because they were on stage.
When you mentioned jazz and improvisation, I was wondering whether you ever had, especially in opera, a sort of unanticipated improvisation in a show where actually being able to cope with that from knowing how to improvise or having the score before you and the harpsichord,
well,
where
I
you
can
could
tell
be
you
a prompter.
Exactly one that happened in the Göttingen Festival, where a countertenor, Kai Wessel, was wearing a tonelay with a sword, and the sword got round the back, and he then sat down, and the sword went up in a phallic position, and he said in English, "I can't sing." Everybody in the audience was rolling about. The other singer was losing it because she was the only person on stage. And so Hanneke van Proestdijk, the other harpsichordist, and me just improvised until everybody calmed down. And we just kept going as if nothing could happen. Because the one thing you can't do with the flute is laugh and play, but you can laugh and play playing the harpsichord. So while our orchestra was picking itself up the floor, these singers were, in one case, we hope, readjusting his costume, we were able to keep going because we had the music and that was our job.
Right.
There was another one. It didn't happen to me. It happened to a friend of mine in The Marriage of Figaro, where Cherubino has to escape out of the window when the count is outside. And in jumping off the window, Cherubino kicked the back of the set, which fell over, causing the two side pieces to fall over. The count then has to come on, and the first line in the English translation is, "All is just as I left it," which turned out, of course, not to be true. He managed to get that line out and just collapsed. That actually did bring the curtain down. Things do happen. As it says in, I think it's Sheridan the Critic, when someone says, "Would you like to hear us in the morning when we are perfect?" Sheridan is supposed to have said, "Nothing in the entire history of the theatre has been perfect. If it were, no one would bother to come."
So a question from the audience. Please do tell us more about the San Francisco Conservatory of Music.
Well, I have an honorary doctorate from there, about which I'm very proud. And had to speak at commencement, which was wonderful because all these fantastic kids were there. If you've not been to the building, it's got a fantastic concert hall in it, which used to be the lobby of a hotel. So it has one of those lovely balconies halfway up where mothers can spy and make sure there's no French kissing going on. Because no cell phones then, so you couldn't give daughter a little call. They could just make their disapproval known, presumably the fluttering of fans or...
Drop something off.
Drop something. But it's got a one... Larry Kierkegaard did a fantastic job with the acoustic. It's a wonderful place. It's one of the two great conservatories of music on the West Coast, the other being the Colburn School down in LA. And the students that they have there are finding jobs in orchestras and opera companies all over the world. It's a great place, and I think it's also one of the things that makes San Francisco a really musical center of the state, that it has everything from the music conservatory. It has the Crowton School in Berkeley, it's another one which is teaching kids, and it has a junior division as well, so you can get stuff from any child who has the slightest talent can be taken from a young age right through, and it's a great place. And do look out their concert series, because the students are wonderful to listen to, and it's in a great place to hear them play.
And last question, I feel like I'm doing the Republican candidates here, but hopefully the questions been more pleasurable.
Excuse me while I do my hair.
How has Philharmonia Baroque evolved as a music group and as an organization, and are there more players available today?
Yes, there are more players available today. We're in very good hands, courtesy of our donors and the audience. When I first came in 1985, we did about 12 concerts a year, and we're now close to 40, I think, with stuff outside touring and so on, and we record. And what's great is that Period Instruments back in 1985 was sort of, what shall I say, it was all a bit alternative, it was a bit out there, we were a bit radical. Now it's become rather mainstream, and we're actually doing better, which is good. And that doesn't answer your question, but I'm going to answer the question you didn't ask, because we actually looked it up. When someone said, what does Baroque mean, or Baroque as it's pronounced here? And since we looked the answer up, I can tell you that it is, and since Kate is wearing two of them, it refers to misshapen pearls, which are elaborate and slightly sort of interesting shapes.
Beautiful but imperfect.
And so what you have in that music is well-defined structure with ornament, lavish and slightly odd and bizarre things to go with it, in the same way as Rococo comes from Rocaille, which is jeweled grottos with gemstones. So it's all to do with being slightly out there, which is what I hope we are. And long may we continue.
Absolutely. Thank you. That was just lovely, astonishingly refreshing, and enlightening as well. And so our grateful thanks to Nick McGeegan and Kate Van Orden for their wonderful conversation here today as part of the club's 2015 member-led platform series, Music Matters, and I guess indeed it does. We would like to thank our live audience as well as those who are listening. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 112th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.